And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Yeah, good morning here from the team at Solidarity Breakfast. You're live here on 3CR and the team today is just me, Tobia, your host. Everyone else is out sick, so I will be taking you through a bit of highlights and lowlights that happened this week, as well as some interesting pieces that we've collected throughout the week. But just a reminder at the top that it is subscriber drive, and 3CR relies on our listeners and supporters to remain on air, online, and on point. Make sure you're part of ensuring 3CR continues for another 50 years. There'll be a great event coming up this year celebrating the 50 years of 3CR. And just reminding you that 3CR has no playlists, no focus groups, and no market research. Our programming is created by real people who are passionate about the shows that they make and the communities that they represent. And the communities represented here are over 100 shows. Are a unique ecosystem that doesn't exist really anywhere else on this continent. So if you subscribe, you're not only subscribing to support, of course, the work of your favorite show, which could be Solidarity Breakfast, but you're also supporting a host of First Nations, gender diverse, community, cultural voices, local music, First Nations voices. There's really more than you can pick. And more than you can listen to. We have podcasts, over 50 podcasts a week that we put on, including the Solidarity Breakfast podcast. So make sure if you want to subscribe, you can head on over to 3cr.org.au, or you can call the lovely people at the desk at 03-9419-8377 and sign up via them during office hours, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, I guess. I don't really work in an office, so I'm not really quite sure. Let me take you around some news that's happened this week. Obviously, we saw on Monday the appalling conduct of the New South Wales Police and the New South Wales Government and the New South Wales Judiciary, who moved to ban a lawful protest under tenuous, potentially unconstitutional new anti-protest laws. And then we saw the police absolutely brutalize a whole bunch of protesters for no real reason after they had been kettled. There was no instigating events, despite what the future predictions of Premier Chris Minns saying that the brutality that ensued on Monday was somehow a deterrent for some alternate reality bloodshed that might have happened on the streets of Sydney, but that really only happened in his head because the reality on the ground was much different. We'll hear a report from Comrade Vivian Langford, who was in Sydney, who luckily left before the violence erupted, the police violence erupted. So we'll hear a bit from that later. In the meantime, why were people protesting? They were protesting because President of Israel, Isaac Herzog, was here visiting, purportedly, Prime Minister Albanese saying that it's because the Jewish community was grieving, or some sections of the Jewish community was grieving post-Bondi, but really, and resisting to say that it was for any political means, even though that President Isaac Herzog was doing tours on the ticket of the Royal Air Force being flown all around the country, shaking hands with some of the richest and wealthiest people here, and taking the time to visit schools and give them the blood-soaked flag of Israel to little kids to wave alongside the Australian one. This, as in the Gaza, the Gaza genocide continues and the terror in the West Bank continues. This week, courtesy of Dropsite News, I'll read you some headlines of what has happened in the ground, even in the last 48 hours. Israeli fire kills and wounds several in Gaza. One Palestinian was killed and at least 10 others were wounded by Israeli forces on Thursday, according to Al Jazeera. Mohammed Dabash was killed by Israeli fire in Al-Zarqa area northeast of Gaza City. Israeli troops backed by tanks and bulldozers advanced near the Kuwait roundabout east of Gaza City, opening heavy fire and injuring at least 10 Palestinians along Salah Adin Street, where Palestinian Red Crescent Society crews evacuated 3 wounded under gunfire. Palestinian paramedic dies in Israeli detention. Hatem Rayan, a Palestinian paramedic who was detained by Israel on December 27, 2024, during the siege of Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia, died inside Israel's Niqab prison. The prisoner's media office said his death, quote, brings the number of identified martyrs from the prisoner's movement since October 2023 to 88, including 52 prisoners from the Gaza Strip, describing it as part of a systematic, quote, systematic killing policy and enforced disappearance targeting Palestinian prisoners. Trump to launch Gaza Reconstruction Fund and Stabilization Force at first, quote, Board of Peace meeting. President Donald Trump will unveil a multi-billion dollar reconstruction fund for the Gaza Strip and outline plans for a United Nations authorized international stabilization force at the first formal meeting of his Board of Peace on February 19th in Washington, D.C., Reuters reports. Delegations from at least 20 countries will attend the gathering, with several states reported to contribute several thousand troops. The meeting is also expected to include briefings on the work of the National Committee for the Administration of Gaza, the Palestinian body designed to assume day-to-day governance from Hamas. Whistleblowers say CPJ cancelled its annual index to protect Israel. Whistleblowers told the Electronic Intifada that the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, scrapped its annual impunity index because Israel was set to rank number one. The index, published annually since 2008 and regularly referenced in UN reports, measures countries where journalists are deliberately killed and killers go unpunished. The 2024 edition, covering killings through 2023, ranked Israel second. The 2025 index, reflecting 2024 amid record killings of Palestinian journalists in Gaza, would have pushed Israel to the top of the list. Since the index is calculated as a 10-year rolling rate relative to population, Israel would have been ranked near the top, if not number one, for many years to come, the whistleblowers said. They alleged donor and board pressure played a role. In response to Electronic Intifada, CPJ denied that donor considerations played any role in its decisions with respect to Israel or any other country. But I mean, with that sort of accusation, who can really think any other way that it's that sort of pressure that disrupts the work of an otherwise impartial, well-referenced body. Continuing, Western governments move to oust UN rapporteur over remarks on Gaza. UN refuses to support her. France, Germany, Italy, and the United States have escalated their calls for the removal of UN special rapporteur Francesca Albanese, falsely accusing her of calling Israel, quote, the common enemy of humanity. France's Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot said Paris will formally seek her ouster at the United Nations Human Rights Council session on February 23, 2026, while Germany's top diplomat, Johann Wadepool, and Italy's foreign minister echoed the claims in support of the push. When asked about the controversy, a spokesperson for UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres refused to back Albanese. He told reporters that the UN does not agree with much of what she says and stressed that Albanese operates independently. Supporters of Albanese, including Amnesty International, say the campaign is political retaliation for Albanese's reporting on Israeli violations in the Gaza Strip. Palestinian citizens of Israel suffer disproportionately from crime wave. Five Palestinian citizens of Israel were killed in a 12-hour period yesterday, bringing the number killed in suspected homicides in Palestinian towns within Israel to 45 in 2026. The mayor of Rahat called it a black day, while Balad party leader Sami Abu Shahada said, quote, "This is not culture, this is policy," blaming the Israeli government's racism and police neglect for the crime wave. While Palestinian citizens of Israel make up about 21% of the Israeli population, they accounted for more than 80% of all homicide victims in 2025. And to round out the section on reporting in Palestine, Israeli military assault and settler attacks continue in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces and settlers carried out widespread attacks across the occupied West Bank on Friday, according to Wafa, leading to dozens of arrests and injuries and the destruction of land and property. Settlers assaulted Palestinian towns, including Kfar al-Dik, Talfit, Kalet Makhum, preventing them from working their land, firing live ammunition, and causing injuries and property damage. Israeli forces fired tear gas at worshippers at a mosque in Ramallah and detained five Palestinians in Salfit, as well as a man, his wife, and their children in the Bedouin community of Kalat Maklum. Settlers also cut down hundreds of olive trees in Tur Mus Aya. According to the Wall and Settlement Resistance Committee, January saw a total of 1,872 incidents, 1,404 by Israeli forces and 468 by settlers. These attacks followed Israel's security cabinet approving new measures to tighten control over the West Bank and accelerate settlement expansion. And then just before we move on to Comrade Vivian Langford's report, which if you love her dulcet tones, you could also hear more of her beautiful voice and her excellent reporting on Monday at 5 p.m. on the Climate Action Show. But moving closer to the U.S. regime and empire, Mexican aid ships arrive in Havana after U.S. tightens fuel pressure on Cuba. Two Mexican Navy vessels carrying humanitarian supplies docked this week in Havana, according to Al Jazeera, as the United States continues efforts to cut off fuel imports to Cuba. President Claudia Sheinbaum said that more assistance is on the way and described Mexico's role as, quote, opening the doors for dialogue to develop between the two countries. Locals told reporters that they were grateful for the arrival supplies. Quote, Mexico hasn't abandoned us, a 65-year-old woman from Havana said. Even with pressure from a global superpower, they weren't afraid. Staying in Cuba, Cuba's Deputy Foreign Minister Carlos Fernandez de Cosío told Mexico's newspaper La Jornada that there is no high-level, quote, no high-level dialogue or even sustained mid-level talks with the United States, confirming Dropsite's recent reporting that negotiations with Cuba are not underway. He said Washington's expanded fuel sanctions are deliberately designed to cripple electricity, transport, food productions, water systems, and healthcare, warning the policy sets a dangerous precedent of economic coercion against sovereign states. In response to this, activists plan aid flotilla to Cuba to challenge tightened United States blockade. An international coalition of activists, trade unionists, and humanitarian groups says it will sail next month with food, medicine, and essential supplies to Cuba. The Nuestra America flotilla, backed by figures including the UK's Jeremy Corbyn and former Barcelona mayor Ada Colau, is explicitly modelled on past blockade-challenging missions,
with organiser David Adler saying the goal is to break the siege and deliver life-saving aid to the Cuban people. Now, these are the tactics that we see echoed all around the world. The riots that happened, or the legitimate protests that started in Iran against living conditions in Iran, which were then capitalized and fomented by the CIA and by Mossad. So it seems reported in Al Jazeera and other publications like Dropsite News, Dropsite News, which is an independent media outlet that you can support on their Substack and on their website and on their YouTube, who are one of the only media agencies that are talking to militia members from West Papua. They're talking to government officials in Hamas. They're talking to people in Hezbollah. They're talking to people in Yemen. They're doing the real reporting that is actually really lacking in the mainstream media outlets, and letting you hear what people are actually saying in the countries that have been affected. So, without further ado, let's move now first to the second part of the report that Vivian Langford produced for 3CR.
We have been mourning the death of people in Palestine and Lebanon, and argued from the 9th of February Sydney rally to protest the visit of Isaac Herzog. I saw the police preparation that morning when I was walking the dog in Moore Park. At least 100 police vehicles from the riot squad and a cavernous marquee were set up in readiness, I'd say, for trouble. Later that hot, humid night, I realised how they had been deployed. People contacted me to see if I was okay and to say how they had been pepper sprayed and assaulted at the end of the rally, which had been peaceful, but as the people tried to move out into George Street, they met with huge police presence. The police violence has become the main story. By the end of the week, the Prime Minister and the Premier were thundering about social cohesion when they had rolled out the red carpet like a red rag to a bull, bringing Israel's president into the heart of this city. For 2 years, we have been mourning the death of people in Palestine and Lebanon and arguing for Australia to respect international laws. And they have thundered about social cohesion while dividing us into mourners and protesters. And if you listen to the mainstream media, your heart would bleed for one group and be hardened against the other. As I said in part one, President Herzog got his narrative in early, on the same night as the Bondi attack, before the police would have known anything, really. His voice came over the ABC, blaming the 2 years of what he called anti-Semitic rage, marching freely in our streets. He would only have known that by seeing our mainstream media and not hearing what was said at those rallies, like the rest of the population who don't really know what is said at the rallies. We can't have social cohesion if this untrue narrative is promoted. 3CR listeners are lucky. You have heard over 100 weeks the voices from those streets. You would know they have never been anti-Semitic. They are not about hardening hearts and keeping our minds in the darkness. You would know that our society is not divided into mourners and protesters, as our leaders and media portray it. We are all mourners. And that is the starting point for social cohesion, in my opinion. And in this rally, the consciousness that Sydney is a site of great mourning, of historic genocide, and that ongoing racism is blinding our chance to be a humane society was in the air. Aboriginal people began the speeches. You will hear Vanessa Turnbull-Roberts, then Amal Nasser, Josh Lees, Muhammad Dohi, and Grace Tame. My name is Vivian Langford, reporting for Radio 3CR and Community Radio in Australia.
Jingiwala Nungali Jugan Jugan Nungali. My name is Vanessa Turnbull-Roberts, and I'm a proud Bundjalung Widjibal Waiyabal woman, and it is a privilege to be standing here with my beautiful auntie Lizzie. Yeah, cheer her. First and foremost, before I share a yarn, I would just like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land. This is, was, and always will be sovereign Aboriginal land. I just had to check it was okay with my auntie if I spoke, because you know how it is. But first, we've got some friends. Can we show a nice black power to these Gunjibals up in the sky? Can we let these police know that we are not scared, no matter what authority, no matter how many police officers or Gunjibals that you send out to gate us here in this space, that we will make sure that we are standing, because you allowed a war criminal to walk off a plane on stolen land with no consent from First Peoples, and we say no. You allowed the same man who is bombing children to walk on stolen land. Albo, where is your heart? Albo, where is your dignity? And Albo, where is your care for innocent children? You are locking up Aboriginal children here on Aboriginal land for petty crimes. Yet you welcome a man that is killing innocent children globally, and you roll out the red carpet. Shame! We can see clear as day, the double standards of this government today. And I am ashamed, as an Aboriginal woman who is proud of the country that we have and the beautiful people from all different backgrounds, the fact that this man was allowed to walk on stolen land, we give no consent! Let's tell the AFP to do their job. Arrest Herzog. Arrest. 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 Tell those two fellas over there with a drone. Arrest. 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 Tell the snipers and everyone around the ICC that are doing hidden surveillance. Arrest. Arrest. Arrest! Arrest! The regime that happens over from Israel that is committing a genocide against Palestinian people is the same genocide that has happened here since invasion. We have children being forcibly removed. We have 10-year-olds locked up who still have their baby teeth. And make no mistake, it is the policing state that is criminalizing and surveillancing our children. It is the same state that is protecting a murderer. And the very reason that you are all out here today is because of black resistance, and it's because of the First People's power. You see, this was intentional. And my dear brother, Paul Dungay, who has led every single First Nations movement with the Black Caucus here on Gadigal country, he has brought this country together to remember his dear uncle who was killed in custody. And every time this policing state opens negotiations and authorities, we need to get more creative. You don't want us to march? Release our children from prison! Stop locking up kids! But last week, there was nowhere near this amount of numbers. And I'm so deeply grateful that you are all here today. But I need to send a reminder. When the sovereign people of these lands call for your heart medicine, call for your show up, and call for your caretaking, show up, because it authenticates your movement, and it authenticates from here to Palestine, to Congo, to Rohingya, to the Philippines, that this is, was, and always will be Aboriginal land. We say no to war criminals. Chris Minn should be ashamed of himself. Anthony Albanese, what are you doing? You were here once with us demanding an end to the Israeli state and all the violence it's committed. What changed your heart? You opened up a red carpet. So what do we want to do? Arrest! 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 Arrest. We are citizens too. We are allowed to walk freely on this land. This is, was, and always will be Aboriginal land. I did not survive the family policing system to stand up here and talk to someone that doesn't know what they're talking about. This is, was, and always will be Aboriginal land. And until your rest, Herzog, we will keep marching, keep showing up. From Palestine to First Nations Australia, we are here. And guess what? We're not going anywhere.
My name is Amal. I'm one of the co-chairs of today's rallies. I'm one of the organisers with the Palestine Action Group. And I'll be co-chairing this rally with my comrade, Josh Lees. Today in a press conference, where the Australian media welcomed Isaac Herzog with open arms and with very little critique. There's one journalist who, you know, saw through the lines and asked Herzog, what do you have to say for all of us here today who are mourning the 70,000 killed in Gaza, including the 20,000 children and the genocidal war criminal Herzog? He had to respond. I've come here in goodwill and in a message to the people of Australia. Australia and Israel are close friends and allies since the days of the old. And of course, Australia and Israel are allies because we are standing here today protesting on the graveyards of Indigenous people. This country, the people of this country, committed a genocide against the First Nations people, and they want to act like it didn't happen as they welcome genocidal war criminals here who are doing the same thing to the Palestinian people. This is what our country is, and this is what we have been protesting for the past 2 years, a country which allies itself and a country which has aided, abetted, and greenlit the genocide of the Palestinian people, the crime of all crimes. And we have one message for Albanese here today. We have one message for Chris Minns. Arrest Herzog. Arrest.
And I want everyone to remember, next time Chris Minns or some other politician or some other Daily Telegraph journalist complains about how disruptive our protests are, how they cost the government millions of dollars. Let's not forget what our government has done, which is pass a series of unconstitutional laws and shut down an entire city to roll out the red carpet for a war criminal. And we know there's a concerted attack on our movement going on all around the place because they see us as a threat. They see us as a threat to social cohesion, a threat. And they're right. We are a threat to their rotten order of genocide and war and racism and inequality. We are a threat to the rule of warmongering racist billionaires. We're a threat to authoritarian premiers. We're a threat to war criminals. We're a threat to genocidal regimes. And we are the hope for humanity that we can all live in a better world, in Gaza and everywhere, because that's what we stand for, is a world free of racist violence and inequality, a world for all of us to live in peace together, which is the exact opposite of what our rulers want and are leading us towards. Now, quickly, we are a huge crowd today, of course. Everyone knows what we stand for, that we are 100% against all forms of racism. We stand against anti-Semitism, against Islamophobia, against anti-Palestinian racism, against anti-Aboriginal racism. And we know, as I said, that the media, the politicians always like to scaremonger about any big crowd standing up to their system, but we know we can keep each other safe. We did it, the 300,000 marched over the bridge. This is a piece of cake for us. But yeah, please look out for each other tonight. Keep each other safe. Give each other space where we need to. Now, we know the cops don't want to give us space. Right now, they're trying to stop people coming in because we've already, if you can't see, we've already filled this square and a few others. But we say to the police, if you try to stop people entering this square, you're just going to create another demonstration and another one. It won't do you any good. So let them in. And we also say to the police, if you want to get us out of this square, there's one easy way to do that, and that's to let us march! Let us march! Let us march! Let us march!
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
To 3CR Community Radio
on 8:55 a.m.
Yeah, you're listening to 3CR Solidarity Breakfast Saturday morning. That song was by Salwa Katrib. It's called Shufi Kalfel Baher. There's more of that, and there's more of Vivian's excellent, excellent reporting. I will include everything in the podcast so you can listen to Grace Tame and the others we didn't quite get a chance to listen to, just because I have prepared a packed episode for everyone. A reminder that it is subscriber drive, so you are hearing here news and productions that you wouldn't hear on any other radio in this country. So make sure that you head to 3cr.org.au or you call the line 94198377 during office hours and you subscribe. The rates are $40 for concession, $80 wage. And of course, if you're a band or an organization, you're more than welcome to donate $150 and support the station that supports you. Moving on to a protest that I attended in Perth on the 5th of January, just as the United States regime illegally kidnapped and sequestered First Lady Celia Flores and President of Venezuela Nicolas Maduro, I attended a rally out front of the U.S. Consulate there that was put together by a whole different lot of realities, including one of which was Socialist Alliance, the Perth chapter over there. And we'll be hearing from Sam Wainwright, who used to also be a councillor at the Council of Fremantle.
No blood for oil! No blood for oil! No blood for oil! Pretend. No blood for oil!
Thank you.
No blood for oil!
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 We know! We know that this is not about helping the Venezuelan people. Trump has said quite clearly, this act of terrorism will cost us nothing because we'll extract payment for it out of the Venezuelan land.
Shame.
This grab for resources must stop. And now I'd like to introduce Sam Wainwright. He's speaking from the Socialist Alliance and also for Stop AUKUS WA. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks so much, Ellie. Now, I was a councillor at the City of Fremantle for 12 years, and one of the residents I represented was a chap called Nelson, who lived in Bromley Road, Hilton. And he would always be quite sombre and depressed on September 11 every year, because of the other September 11. The September 11, where the United States engineered a coup in his country, overthrew the elected government, killed 30,000 people, and detained without trial people like him. People like him, who had their fingernails ripped out, who had electrodes attached to their genitals, in a coup that was organised, orchestrated by the United States, while a US Navy ship was off the Chilean coast helping coordinate the coup plotting. And if we look at 150 years of history in Central and Latin America, it's been US interference blocking self-determination, blocking democracy, undermining the future of people. And the same is true in Venezuela. And we should, you know, the US attack on Venezuela didn't just happen in the last 48 hours. The United States has been imposing a blockade, economic sanctions on Venezuela for over a decade. Now, in medieval times, the first thing you wanted to do when you wanted to wage war against the country, your opponent, was you laid siege to their castle. So it's really important to understand that economic sanctions from a rich country against a country of the global south is an act of war, and it costs lives. And epidemiologists can actually point to the tens of thousands of Venezuelans who died, who need not die, because of the effect on the Venezuelan economy and access to healthcare and medicine and all that sort of thing. So tens of thousands of people have already been killed as a consequence of US policy towards Venezuela. And as people have already mentioned, anyone who thinks for a moment that Trump's intervention is going to usher democracy for Venezuela has got absolute rocks in their heads. We know there are Venezuelans who don't like the current Venezuelan government. But Trump has made it clear we are going to rule Venezuela. He's made it absolutely clear. Anthony Albanese puts out this idiotic, asinine press statement about, oh, hoping this will, you know, open the door to democratic transition in Venezuela. Trump has made it clear that it won't. He's made it absolutely clear. Now, people sometimes say, it's always been this way. Like the United States, the Western powers and the United States in particular, you know, they've never really obeyed international law. There's never been a rules-based order. And on one level, that's true. You know, we think about the invasion of Iraq. But there are two things that are new, and that is that Trump represents, in my estimation, a faction of the ruling elite in the United States that has decided that it's no longer worth the cost, politically or financially, to even pretend to obey international law and multilateral institutions. They don't even pretend. With the invasion of Iraq, you know, there's all this palaver about the so-called weapons of mass destruction. They took a resolution to the UN, but Trump has made it clear, fuck that, we're not bothering with it. We're just gonna go straight for what we want. You've got it, we want it. You know, it's the gangster approach. He's made that very clear. So that is something that's new. But what is interesting is the response of our government. I'll come back to that in a moment. The second thing I'd say, too, that's new is that Trump has made it explicit that he wants a reorientation of US foreign policy, and in which the United States is treated, Latin America is the US backyard. So it's you know, Monroe Doctrine Mark II, turbocharged with Trump-style gangsterism. You know, he represents a section of the ruling elite in the United States that feel like they've lost control of Latin America and it needs to be back under their boot. And that's exactly what he's trying to do. He's saying, it's other areas of the world, too far away, we can't control them. But in Latin America, we're gonna call the shots. He's made that really clear. And what I think is so, you know, on one level it's not surprising, but so infuriating is the absolute tepid, useless reaction of Anthony Albanese. And of course, it shouldn't surprise us, given what we've been through with Gaza. But you could still ask, well, you know, surely he could have objected. Like Pedro Sanchez, who's the Prime Minister of Spain, leader of the Spanish Socialist Party, is more or less the Spanish equivalent of the Labour Party in that country. He's actually opposed the United States on Gaza and said there's not going to be any shipments of weapons to Israel through Spain, through Spanish ports and Spanish airports. And he's come out and said, we do not recognise this action. So if he can do it, why can't Australia? Why can't Anthony Albanese? Why can't Anthony Albanese, who was the founding member of the Parliamentary Friends of Palestine in 2014, you know, why can't Anthony Albanese do it? I think that what this shows is that this is the logic of AUKUS. So unlike Spain and Ireland, who haven't done heaps, but they've done the bare minimum, right? They've actually at least called a spade, the logic of AUKUS binds us into US foreign policy. The logic of AUKUS is you cannot criticise US foreign and military policy. So we've seen it on Gaza, and now we see it in Venezuela as well. And in actual fact, the more outrageous things that Trump and people senior in the Trump administration say, the more they double down. And it's almost every single time they come out with something really outrageous, like we want Greenland and Panama or whatever it is, the latest violent brain fart that comes out of the Trump administration. Richard Marles, our defence minister, goes running across the Pacific Ocean to give more of our money to the United States. So, you know, the AUKUS-class submarines aren't going to, if they ever arrive, aren't coming till 2040 or whatever it is, right? So, in theory, the stopgap measure is the United States is going to give us some of the so-called Virginia-class submarines. And the US has said, oh, look, we only produce one or two a year. We're not sure if we can afford to sell you any. So in order to boost the capacity of the US shipbuilding industry, Australia, so far, has made three donations, because it's not a contract, three donations, untied donations, totaling $3 billion. Three times Richard Marles has gone galloping across the Pacific Ocean to fawn at people like Hegseth and give them and promise another $1 billion. That's $3 billion so far, with another instalment to come. A total of $4.5 billion. Untied donation from Australian taxpayers. It's not his fucking money, it's our money. It's money that could have been spent on the NDIS. It could be spent on public transport. It could be spent on women's shelters. You come up the list. The money could be spent on other stuff. No, $4.5 billion untied donation to the United States shipbuilding industry in the hope that they'll sell us a couple of Virginia-class submarines sometime down in the future. Now, Donald Trump is... You see what Trump's like? He's liable to say, in 5 years' time, he's liable to say, actually, you know, fuck it. You're not getting the Virginia-class submarines, but we're going to keep the $4.5 billion. This is the logic of AUKUS. This is the logic of Australia completely prostrating itself to US foreign policy. And you'll have friends and colleagues, I'm sure, who say, oh, but, you know, it's a big dangerous world. We've either got to choose China or the United States. Absolute bullshit. We need to advocate that Australia have an independent foreign policy based on peace and justice in the world. Look at Vietnam, for heaven's sake. Vietnam. Vietnam isn't saying, oh, we've either got to side with China or the United States. Vietnam has been invaded by China and the United States and France and Japan. And it's saying, no, we don't. So a wealthy country like Australia, an island continent, nobody can invade Australia. There is no imminent invasion threat whatsoever. An independent foreign policy based on peace and justice. And as Sophie said, that starts with cancelling AUKUS, no US bases, cut the US alliance. Enough of this alliance with the biggest sponsor of terrorism in the world today. And on the question of Venezuela, we've got to say, we need the Australian government to say, we don't recognise Trump's invasion. We call for the release of Maduro. We call for an end to sanctions and freedom for Latin American people from US interference. I just want to finish by saying, yes, absolutely get involved in Stop AUKUS WA. We really want to power up this campaign. You'll see Leone somewhere with some of these stickers. We want to do a flotilla protest down at Coburn Sound this year. We were actually going to do one late last year, but storm weather prevented us from doing it. And we really want as many people there. And one of the reasons is because this AUKUS project has got so ingrained on every level of government that the AFP has announced the formation of a special task force whose job is to protect AUKUS. So an Australian Federal Police unit has been set up to protect AUKUS. And in its mission statement, it's quite clear. It's not just to protect the physical assets, you know, to stop us getting in canoes and trying to stop a submarine from docking or something like that. We'll try to do that if we can. But it's actually to monitor political activity around AUKUS as well. Political activity. And, you know, a few weeks ago, a delegation from Stop AUKUS met with a member for Fremantle, Simone McGurk, and Tony Papalia was there. And he's the minister basically responsible for trying to develop a defence industry in Western Australia. Because it's now bipartisan policy, federal and state, to try and turn Australia into a major arms exporting country. And so there's now a state government instrumentality that's been set up to try and, you know, get as much of the AUKUS work happening in Australia as possible, and to make Australia a defence leader. I mean, we're already selling arms to wonderful countries like Saudi Arabia, and they want to do more of it. And interestingly, in informal discussion, Papali actually admitted that there is no rules-based order anymore. So they know it's true. They might mouth some shit in front of TV cameras about, oh, you know, Australia, you know, wants to see democratic resolution, blah, 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 blah. But they actually know the truth of the matter. They've read what Trump is doing, and instead of standing up with it, they're going along with it. And we cannot let them do it. We owe it to ourselves and to peace on this planet. Thank you.
We're from Braver College, and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio.
On 8:55 a.m.
Woo! What's going on right now? Is the sound you have? Oh, 6 feet, take it out, blame it on yourself again. Reach and let it out, we can shut it down. These are the symptoms of you.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
A weak solidarity breaking team listener win. Hasn't big Supremo Anthony Albanese's latest attempt at social cohesion worked a treat? For instance, it cohesed thousands and thousands who condemn the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation of the Palestinian non-land, non-people, big time. Even though they did violently attack the police, batons and chemical weapons and fists and sharpened boots with their body parts like torsos and backs and heads. Some evil enough to pray that the poor innocent constabulary would be inflicted with divine intervention, prompting a gentle burst of very non-divine intervention. But let's be clear. Sure, they were Muslims at prayer, but the copper overseeing all this assured there is not a skerrick of racism in the forces of law and order. Indeed, he praised the police for, he said, showing great, you know, like, restraint, leaving us to ponder what it might have looked like if they hadn't. Backed up by Anthony, who immediately attacked those who opposed slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation for causing themselves to be bashed the shit out of. The New South Wales Supremo, oh, perhaps the less said the better, yet again highlighting his socialist credentials. For we should all welcome this guest to our country, should all forget he has been accused of inciting genocide, forget in an election campaign his material, for instance, had a Palestinian in the sights of a rifle, declared they are less than human. Indeed, a litany of racist attacks on the non-land, non-people, although, correction, when Zion says and does such things, it is not racist, but simply expressing its right to defend itself from, from the people who still believe their land is their land, when all the responsible people know it is no longer their land, showing the thousands and thousands who took to the streets are irresponsible. But in fairness, one of the most responsible of the responsible, our very own minister, were going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Penny Left Wing, did finally make a strong statement. The military regime has subjected people to 5 years of violence, widespread human rights violations, and severe humanitarian suffering. Dozens of democratically elected politicians were detained as a communications blackout befell the country, plagued by a civil war, rampant repression. This crisis continues unabated. In 2026, an estimated 16.2 million people will require life-saving humanitarian assistance, and over 3.6 million people are internally displaced. Strong stuff compared to Penny's usual profound waffling nothingness. She's finally decided the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation have gone too far, even by her support for Zion. Well, sorry, listener, no. She was talking about Myanmar. Penny would never utter such condemnation of Zion. Rather, she's happily shaking the hand of its alleged war criminal welcome visitor. And maybe Anthony and Penny could explain the iteration and reiteration, the resolution of the slaughter must be a two-state solution, without telling us where the two states should be, and more importantly, given that Zion Supremo Benjamin not another Yahoo and his henchmen, and they are all men as far as I can see, declare there will never be a non-people, non-land state, reinforced while they were shaking hands, welcoming and being lectured about anti-Semitism by their guests, governments annexing even more of what's left of the West Bank. No official complaint from True the Aussie. Anthony Penny, an explanation wouldn't go astray, wouldn't hurt. Another, like our police, who hasn't a racist bone in his body, US, of the UN, of the US, of the world, big supremo Donald Trump or the poor. So a social media post depicting Michelle and Barack Obama as apes, a racist trope, was clearly not racist, confirmed when Donald's press secretary warned the media, please stop the fake outrage and report on something today that actually matters, like racism doesn't. And anyway, the Don isn't, although a number, well, lots of journos, failed to take her advice, suggesting outrageously just maybe the Don is a touch racist. And one black Don does love. Coal. Clean, beautiful coal. The greatest clean, beautiful coal ever, ever, he echoes former Troop of the Aussie Big Supremo Scummo. Those admirable human beings, coal executives, mining executives, and energy industry leaders, that is, fossil energy industry leaders, are joining the Commander-in-Chief at the White House. Maybe it's time for a name change, the Trample the Poor Black House, to announce new orders that government and the train killer industry must buy coal power. Clean, beautiful coal power. To back up his clean, beautiful words, Donald is also handing $246 million to upgrade six coal plants. And the same press secretary, reaffirming we can believe everything we read, see and hear in the capitalist press, spouted, the big supremo will discuss how clean and beautiful coal is not only keeping the lights on, but also driving down the cost of electricity across the country. A truism expressed regularly by the clean, beautiful coal and gas and oil behemoths here in Troop de Aussie, that renewables will inflate energy costs and, oh, that will hurt the families and dear little children they so care about. So, there has to be another explanation for why, when in the December quarter, renewables for the first time provided more than half the power, and there was huge demand, why wholesale electricity prices were 44% lower than the same quarter a year ago, and 43% lower than the previous quarter. There must be another explanation. A Griffith University Associate Professor and Climate Counsellor Joel Gilmore, who's been studying these things for years, did say, renewables are not driving power bills up. My research has shown they are already helping to bring them down. If we want affordable, secure power, the answer is to finish modernising our energy system, not clinging to technologies already failing us. What would he know, listener? What would he know compared to the fossil giants who pollute to their big heart's content day after day? To make matters worse, for the fossil giants, an increasing number of groups and organisations, including a group called the Superpower Institute, has put out a report suggesting we should stop subsidising the fossils and, oh dear, how's this for rubbish, make the polluters pay. A polluter pays principle means those who impose climate costs will face them directly. It blasphemes. Oh, and if we think that 44% forward electricity wholesale prices will be reflected in our retail electricity bills, come on, no need to answer that. Feature page article this week, headline, should taxpayers help fund $50,000 a year private schools? No problem answering that one either, listener. Sadly, governments have different ideas. Better to starve the public system than upset the filthy rich. Like the transfer of public health funds to prop up the private health system, including insurance, which would be unnecessary if we had a genuine free universal health care system, which Medicare was designed to be before former big supremo little Johnny Howard in particular used it to prop up his mates in the private sector. Not that he's an orphan there. And those who are around will recall the spectacularly courageous performance by then Socialist Party supremo and would-be big supremo Kim Beazneys. We oppose the move. He was all strength. But if elected, we will not change it. Ah, courage. Well, one of the biggest private hospital chains, Health Coptis Taxpayers, has hit the financial brick wall due to the usual competence of the private sector. and will roll much of its empire into a charitable trust, meaning it will pay no tax, prompting even one of the more neoliberal economic journalists to point out this will rob the public purse of $100 million a year. Instead, this will prop up its cash flows by taxpayers not paying tax. We're all taking a financial hit. Doesn't matter. It's private, so it's more efficient. And we all love, love, love the Walt Disney Company, and we are thrilled its Troubadourzy subsidiary racked up a massive revenue increase to more than $1 billion, the vast amount of which was paid as royalties to its US of parent, meaning that it must make the company feel so disappointed it paid hardly any tax in Troubadourzy. Well, obviously, it has to pay royalties to itself. And rest assured, have no fear, there is no doubt it is meeting its legal tax obligations. On the public purse, the political year ended, we recall, with the caring business class, hayseed and sheepshit parties, sometimes coalition and sometimes not, very righteously condemning the abuse of parliamentary expenses. And they certainly wouldn't. Even though three of them, Ted No-Brain, Michaela Costa-Workers and Dan Tea and Free Champagne, charged thousands on travel and accommodation to attend a caring business class party fundraiser in Sydney. But fear not, No-Brain also conducted parliamentary business. Michaela also conducted parliamentary business, and Dan, we guessed it, yes, conducted parliamentary business. As a by-the-by, Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young racked up about $50,000 flying her husband to Canberra, which he's allowed to do, but then he's a lobbyist who works in Canberra. And here's the interesting bit. One of his clients is big polluter Rio Tinto the Planet. Must make for interesting breakfast conversation. And as the government's private sector housing solution falls further and further behind schedule, it's found the perfect solution to providing lots and lots of public housing. It's named 67 unwanted train killer department sites, 16 in Victoria. Ideal for public housing with the government already owning the land. Oh, sorry, my mistake. I misread it. It plans to flog off the sites to private developers. We keep forgetting governments washed their hands of public housing years ago. Aware the solution to housing those who can't afford a roof over their heads lies in the super-efficient private sector. Another promising possibility down the private profit gurgler. Oh, and that senior counsel's reporting to the evil CFMEU. 200 men on a building site is an ideal scenario for drug dealing, he tells us. And I thought, but then 200 men and women in a barrister's chambers, for instance, must also be an ideal scenario for drug dealing. I'm sure he can explain that. And how remiss we haven't mentioned the big, big news of the week. Forget the visit by a war criminal. Big, big, big news that has the Canberra Press Gallery having multiple orgasms. And why haven't we mentioned it, listener? Well, couldn't give a stuff, and what's it matter, spring to mind. Suppose right now Susan is gushing over the roses and chocolate she's received from Angus for Valentine's Day. Finally, as Herzog addressed a Zionist gathering here Thursday with glowing praise from our state socialist supremo, he said we should be protesting against evil Iran, which kills thousands of its own people. We do not kill our own people, we kill the other. At Thursday's rally, and Monday and Thursday were both, as we know, huge and inspiring with excellent speeches, one speaker said Herzog was not welcome on stolen land, and I thought, well, that's not going to upset him one bit. His position is based on, he lives his life on, stolen land. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Kevin. As always, absolutely cutting insights. And for this last section, since my comrades aren't here and they're all off sick, but they did recommend that we commemorate one brilliant mind that passed away this year, one Dr. Michael Parenti. And so I went through the archives and I found Maybe one of the more relevant pieces, even though all of his books are increasingly relevant or always relevant, this one is an excerpt from a talk he did as part of a series on the darker myths of empires at the College of Dubois.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. I was thinking that the title Britannica, and there's even I was thinking that the title of this talk, The Darker Myths of Empire, is probably a misnomer. It really should be The Darker Truths of Empire, because I'm not going to talk about, I am going to talk about some of the myths too. and what there is really, there's an enormous disparity between what empires actually do and how they're represented in history. This is what I've found, that empires are pretty much written about by people who live in the imperial countries. And so the treatment of empires is rather celebratory. Empires are often represented as creations of peace. They're even given names of peace, right? Pax Romana, the Roman peace. The Roman peace was a brutal, bloody world conquest, as I'll mention in more detail in a minute. Pax Britannica, and there's even Pax Americana, which was, it's been the title of at least two books, one many years ago by Ronald Steele. Empires are often represented as bringing stability, justice, and prosperity to their subject peoples. They're represented as selfish things, large impersonal organizations that bring order where once there had been disorder. Just so you don't think I'm attacking straw men, oh, who says that, who thinks that way, let me read to you from one great student of empire. He wrote a masterpiece of a multi-volume work. It's called The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Edward Gibbon. And this is what Edward Gibbon says. The obedience of the Roman world was uniform, voluntary, and permanent. The vanquished nations blended into one great people. They resigned the hope, nay, even the wish, of resuming their independence. The vast Roman Empire was governed by absolute power under the guidance of virtue and wisdom. Yeah, right. That's the description he gives. I mean, not a word here about an empire built on shattered armies, sacked towns, burned crops, raped women, slaughtered herds, enslaved prisoners of war, oppressively overtaxed populations. Not a word about that. Empires are even sometimes represented as unintentional. That's when it really starts to get cute. This should have been called maybe the funnier myths of empire, this part of it. The product of unconscious circumstance. When I was a youth, in my salad days, I used to hear that the British Empire was put together in a fit of absent-mindedness. Did anybody else ever hear of that? It was an old saying. It used to be an old saying about the British Empire. I see only some of the old timers are nodding. I'm glad that phrase has gone out of style. Cyril Robinson, a British historian, he says the same thing about the Roman Empire. He says it about both of them, his empire and the Romans. He says, it was perhaps almost as true of Rome as of Great Britain, that she acquired her world domination in a fit of absence of mind. How do you build an empire in a fit of absence of mind? How do you do that? You just kind of get up and say, oh, let's go conquer Gaul today. Oh, did I say that? Or what are those armies doing up there? No. John Morley, English political leader and writer, talking about the British Empire, 1877. We have had imposed upon us by the unlucky prowess of our ancestors the task of ruling millions of alien dependents. We undertake it with a disinterestedness and execute it with a skill of administration to which history supplies no parallel. Yeah, again, let's deconstruct that a minute, would you? I mean, millions of alien dependents? Who made them dependents? They didn't ask to be made dependents on the British. They were brutally conquered by the British. They were independents until the British came along. You didn't inherit them. You went out and got this whole thing. And it wasn't undertaken with a disinterestedness. And it goes on like that. The U.S., too. Here, very recently, the year 2003, The Economist, a conservative British publication, no author. Empires are born in funny ways, and sometimes via the law of unintended consequences, by accident. And so with the American Empire. I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? We hear that today also in a slightly different idiom. We hear that the United States, in terms of the United States, we hear the United States was, I mean, that's the first one where I found the absent-mindedness thing used again. But generally, there's another way of saying it. Say, the United States was thrusted onto the world stage. Or after World War II, we found ourselves having to take up the mantle of world leader. But we were just thrusted into this thing. They never say who did the thrusting. You know, the Canadians and the Mexicans kind of pushing us and say, come on, come on. Go rule the world, maybe. Leave us alone for a while or something. I don't know. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, I think a moment's reflection would tell you that empires are products of deliberate contrivance, of deliberate confection, planning, calculation, and manipulation. No social order can maintain itself in the long run. No social order can maintain itself without conscious human agency. In fact, that's why you have a state. The state is the conscious human agency of coercion to maintain a particular set of interests and order, which don't necessarily always look out for our interests, you know. Americans have been taught that empires and imperialism are something that other countries do. When I was in the sixth grade, my teacher said to us, the United States is the only advanced country that does not have colonies. We do not have colonies. And we'd look on this big, we'd have this big map, and there'd be these of the United States, and there'd be these box inserts all around the sides. It'd be Alaska, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines. I'm really dating myself. These were not independent, and nor were they states yet. In fact, Puerto Rico is still owned by the U.S. So we'd say to her, Miss Myers, what are these blocks here? What are those? Aren't those our colonies? She said, the United States does not have colonies. It has territories or possessions. So, see, that's the magic of words. You wish away, or you define away, all sorts of brutal histories and realities by just using a different word. You got the administration today in Washington saying that the Geneva Convention does not apply to the people who are being held in captivity under very bad conditions at Guantanamo by the United States, because they're not prisoners of war. They're enemy combatants. But you know, enemy combatant incarcerated by your military, that's the definition of a prisoner of war. That's what a prisoner of war is. You get the enemy's combatant and you make prisoners out of them. So this use of, it's interesting how terms are now just being used to wish away things and situations. And this has happened with empire as with any of these other deceptions. The denial of empire in the U.S. was made easier by the rather early innovation of what's called neo-imperialism or neo-colonialism. Imperialism is the thing that empires do. So all those years when the communists were saying the U.S. is a capitalist imperialist nation, and we used to say, oh, a lot of commie rhetoric, turns out it's true. We are. We go out and we control, not we, they, the people who run this country, go out and control other places. But much of that control with the American Empire in the very early stage was neo-colonial or neo-imperialist. And neo-imperialism was practiced, for instance, with Cuba. In 1905, after controlling Cuba for about 7 years, direct occupation with U.S. troops, the Americans turned around to the Cubans and said, look, we stole you fair and square from the Spaniards in a war which the Spaniards didn't even want to fight. They were willing to negotiate and leave Cuba and all that, but we really didn't want them to leave because then we'd have no excuse to invade you and invade the Philippines and take that from Spain and invade Puerto Rico, invade Guam, annex the Hawaii Islands, all these things that we did. So we stole you fair and square, but it doesn't look so good, we being a republic and a democracy, doesn't look so good to have a colony. Miss Myers in sixth grade wouldn't approve of it. No, they didn't say that. But so they said, so we're going to give you your independence, and you're going to have your own flag. It's going to be red, white, and blue, but you get only one star because you're just a little island, you know. And you'll have your own money. You won't have to use U.S. dollars. You can use pesos or whatever you want. And you can put your own leaders on your money. You don't have to have George Washington. We're flex on this. You can have that. You have your Guardia Civile who will take care, make sure the people stay in line and crack heads. And if they can't do it that well, we have a little clause here in this treaty which says the U.S. Marines can come in any time to clean house on you. And so your own independence, you can continue to speak Spanish even. How's that? And the only thing you do for us in exchange is we will continue to control your and own your tobacco industry, your sugar industry, and control all your imports and exports and your nickel mines and your oil refineries and all your relationships with third nations. You know, other nations other than us, we will have a final say on all of that. So you're independent. Enjoy. Go out there and enjoy. So what you do is you give them the husk of independence, the shell of it, and you just take the substance of it. That's what neo-imperialism is like. Now, what's happened in recent years is it's become acceptable to refer to the United States as an empire. When I wrote Against Empire, which first came out 10 years ago, I mean, I had people come up and say, oh, come on, Parenti, aren't you going over the top? I mean, empire, what do you talk, U.S. as an empire? Now there's about 20 books out on the U.S. empire, isn't there? Sorrows of Empire, The Follies of Empire, The Crimes of Empire, Empire at the Crossroads, Empire in Crises. I mean, just go out. Everybody's using the term. It's become a hot term. And it's good to know I was ahead of my pack here on this. And what's even more interesting is that the term empire has become acceptable to conservative commentators. You can turn on Fox and you could hear people say things like, well, we're the strongest nation in the world, and we're a superpower, and we have every right to act like a superpower, and we better act like a superpower. I mean, it's almost as if this power gives you entitlement. We're an empire, and we better get used to the idea that we're an empire, and this is the kind of thing. We're an empire with all the obligations and opportunities and responsibilities of empire. So, what's left out again from all this history, all this commentary, is why empires? That was another thing I found. was not. Is this on, by the way? Yeah, yeah. I feel I'm. There it is. Maybe I have to get a little closer. Why do people go out and conquer other places? It's usually assumed. I mean, you can read a whole history of the Mongol Empire, you know, or they, you know, and such. And Genghis Khan came here, and then they went here, and they destroyed these towns, and they went there, and they fought that battle, and they did, and all these details, and all through. But nobody ever asked, well, why? Why are they doing all this stuff? Is this just stuff happens again? You know, it's just in a fit of ferocious absent-mindedness, they're at it again? Or what is it? Actually, it's not conquest just for conquest's sake. It's not power just for power's sake. It's rarely power just for power's sake. Of course, individuals try to pursue and project their careers to get up there to get into positions of power and will sell their souls for anything. But generally, even they have to operate in a field of interest. There are interests involved. There are very real material interests at stake. There's plunder, and there's tribute, and there are resources and markets, and there's expropriating the land and the crops and the natural resources and the minerals and the wealth and the cheap labor, or in the case of Rome, the slave labor. Let me go back again and read you something else about the Roman Empire. It gets wearisome to read what all the British imperialist chroniclers say about the Roman imperialists and the Roman imperialists themselves, what they say. So let me give you a Roman imperialist, Sallust, writing at the time of Julius Caesar. This is what he says about Rome. Avarice was a thing almost unknown. Justice and righteousness were upheld, not so much by law, but by natural instinct. They governed by conferring benefits on their subjects, not by intimidation. That's what he said about the Roman Empire. I mean, it's mind-boggling, you know? It's really rather mind-boggling. Is he talking about the Romans who went into Egypt and plundered and stripped that entire rich kingdom and tore up everything that ever there and turned it into a granary which they plundered? If you want to know why so many countries in the third world are so poor, just look at the history of imperialism. They weren't naturally and inevitably poor. They were made poor. Underdevelopment was something that was imposed on them. They were developing. They had wealth. Many of them had very advanced civilizations. They were forced back and plundered and impoverished. Going back to Rome, King Mithridates, when the Romans came in to his small kingdom, he said, "The Romans have constantly had the same cause, a cause for making war upon all nations, peoples, and kings, the insatiable desire for empire and wealth." And wealth, there's another word, and wealth. He put those together, empires and wealth. Caledonian chief, Caledonia's area, part of what we now call Scotland, right? Calgacus, I don't know how it's pronounced. "You find in the Romans an arrogance which no reasonable submission can elude. Brigands of the world, they have exhausted the land by their indiscriminate plunder. They create a desolation and call it peace. Our goods and money are consumed by taxation. Our land is stripped of its harvest to fill their granaries." Now we're getting a little closer to things, aren't we? Now we can see what it is. Empires are enormously profitable, mostly for the ruling class. Empires are also enormously costly, mostly for the common populace. The people of Rome didn't do too well on the empires. They got a grain dole and that was it. They often paid the price in blood. They were piled up in tenements and like, and that's the truth of every empire. The empire feeds off the resources of the republic. And that was true of the Roman Empire in its days of right to the late Republic. That was true of the British Empire, and that's true today. The people pay the taxes and do without essentials so that the patricians can pursue their far-off plunder. The center is bled so that the perimeter can expand. Athens is defunded and starved so that Sparta can batten and grow ever more powerful.
We'll leave Parenti there, and you can check the rest of that Darker Myths of Empire talk that he did on YouTube, and it'll be linked in the show notes. That's all for us here at Solidarity Breakfast this week. We'll leave you with a song by Franti, an Italian post-punk band called Vento Rosso. That's all for us. See you next week.
Sempre nuove, resta fermo nella mente, così posso ritrovarti con le dita dei pensieri. Come tracce di altri sogni, faccio fuori la paura. Tempo.